From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, and this is On Point. In the news this week, before dawn cracked over Washington, Congress passed a $400 billion temporary budget deal. Hours earlier, Republican senator and deficit hawk Rand Paul tried to sink it.
There is no oversight. You realize what they are passing is all of the money glommed together in one bill. No one will read the bill. No one knows what's in it. And there is no reform in the bill.
On Wednesday, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi stood tall for the Dreamers in four-inch heels in a solo filibuster-style record-breaking speech.
For the last 8 hours, I have had the privilege of reading the testimony of so many Dreamers. I still have more, but I'll either just submit.
White House damage control after a top aide resigns following reports of abuse by two ex-wives, which his bosses allegedly knew about. White House Deputy Press Secretary Raj Shah faced the press yesterday.
We all could have done better over the last few days in dealing with this situation, but the emerging reports were not reflective of the individual who we had come to know.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eliana Johnson, Van Newkirk, and Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Can you believe it? A second government shutdown, albeit for a few hours, in less than a month? Will the new budget avert new problems? Or are lawmakers just kicking the can down the road till March? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Eliana Johnson, national political reporter for Politico. Eliana, welcome. Great to have you.
Hi, Indira. Great to be with you.
Also with us from Washington is Van Newkirk, a policy and politics reporter for The Atlantic. Van, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Indira. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Indira, Van, and Eliana.
All right. So Washington went on an overnight roller coaster ride as Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul delayed a vote past midnight, forcing yet another government shutdown. Paul was protesting the burgeoning deficit created by the budget deal. But by dawn, the Republican majority House voted to pass the bipartisan spending measure that the Senate already approved. So, Eliana, what are the major line items that we, the taxpayers, are now funding in this budget?
You know, they approved $300 billion, I think, is the most eye-popping number in discretionary spending. And that is really surprising for a Republican Party that controls every lever of government. And so you saw Kentucky Senator Rand Paul stage an hours-long protest, essentially, to call out the hypocrisy of Republicans who decried debt, the increase in debt and deficits during the Obama administration. But given that President Trump, also a Republican, doesn't care much about the debt and deficits, we don't see Republicans raising eyebrows and essentially doing the opposite, approving a massive increase in debt and deficits and increasing discretionary spending limits and the debt ceiling under a Republican administration.
All right, Eliana, it sounds like you're saying that Rand Paul is right, that his own party was going back on its vows to balance the budget, trim the national debt. This bill authorizes $500 billion in spending over the next 2 years, meaning that the $20 trillion national debt will grow. The GOP was supposed to be the party of fiscal responsibility. But Van, tell us, now that they have passed this budget, what are some of the actual programs that are going to be funded? As you divide it up as a pie chart, explain to us what the major spending is on.
So we have a lot of this does go to the military. I mean, I think that's sort of the bipartisan consensus is you increase the funding to the military, you again increase discretionary spending, and most of spending across the board that the Democrats wanted on health care, on domestic poverty programs, those are going to make it. I still think we have now this is the second straight deficit increasing big package from Republicans after the big tax bill. And so we're looking at an era now where the budget hawk Republican seems to be a thing of the past. This still does not settle the immigration bill question and the big DACA question that leader that Pelosi was talking about during her stand on the floor. And so this sets yet again another showdown on approaching March 5th when we're basically going to have to go through this whole entire drama once more.
Yeah, well, Van, thank you for mentioning that, because House Speaker Paul Ryan, just before this early morning 240 to 186 House vote, vowed to lawmakers that even though it didn't happen last night, there will eventually, and he didn't say when, be a vote to protect the so-called Dreamers, who were brought here illegally as children and grew up in the U.S., including 900 who currently are in our military. Let's listen.
My commitment to working together on an immigration measure that we can make law is a sincere commitment. We will solve this DACA problem. Once we get this budget agreement done, and we will get this done for no matter how long it takes for us to stay here, we will focus on bringing that debate to this floor and finding a solution.
And as you mentioned, Van, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi stood on the floor Wednesday in four-inch heels without a break for 8 hours advocating for the Dreamers. It was the longest speech on the floor of the House in more than a century.
Every day, courageous, patriotic Dreamers lose their status. Every day, the American dream slips further out of reach. As members of Congress, we have a moral responsibility to act now to protect Dreamers who are the pride of our nation and are American in every way but on paper.
So, Jack, what was the goal of Nancy Pelosi's speech, and what are the chances that she and Paul Ryan will actually be able to hash out a compromise?
Well, remains to be seen. Paul Ryan has sort of taken protean positions on this. On the one hand, yes, he says we're going to vote. On the other hand, there's a hedge built in there. We're going to vote on something that the president will accept. Well, if that's the case, what will the president accept? We still don't know that. But, you know, just hearing Paul Ryan's voice, I want to dial back just to the question we were talking about earlier, this spending bill combined with the tax bill. In 2009, Paul Ryan, of course, was leading the fiscal hawks, saying that the President Obama's stimulus program, which was countercyclical, we were in the worst economic crisis since the Depression, that program would make us like Greece. We would be bankrupted within a year or 2 years or whatever it was. And, of course, now he's just voted first for this huge tax cut, now for this big spending increase, which could increase the deficit by $13 trillion over a decade. Interest payments on this could grow from $300 billion to $800 billion a year. Interest payments. If this is fiscal conservatism, I'm the queen of Romania.
Oh, well, Queen Jack, we will see about that. All right, let's bring in one of our callers. Wes is calling us from Nashville, Tennessee. Wes, go ahead. Welcome.
Hello, Indira, and hello, queen of Romania. So Rand Paul says he's concerned about budget deficits, but he voted for the tax cut plan that I guess would increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion. So to me, it just seems ridiculous for him to suddenly be concerned about tax cuts or budget deficits.
Okay.
When clearly, that didn't make any sense.
All right. A tough question from our listeners. That's what we like. Eliana, I'm throwing that one to you.
Well, I don't think I could stress enough how little spending Rand Paul wants the federal government to do. So it's true that Rand Paul voted for a tax cut bill, but Rand Paul would like to cut virtually all federal spending from foreign aid, which I don't think you could find one other member of the Senate who wants to cut as much foreign aid as Rand Paul does to domestic programs, essentially from A to Z. So I don't necessarily think Rand Paul is inconsistent. I just think that in terms of his political ideology, he's rare even among Republicans in that he really does want to slash federal spending. And it sees that as consistent with cutting taxes as well.
All right. Well, here's another comment from one of our listeners on our website who says, I have to question whether Democrats are serious about solving the DACA problem, referring to the delayed action for childhood arrivals. I'm beginning to believe that they prefer keeping it as an issue rather than fixing the problem. Trump has offered a solution that I'm frankly shocked Democrats didn't immediately seize upon. It seems as if Trump has been boxed in by the Democrats. Van Newkirk, what do you say to that?
Well, I think the problem here for Democrats and frankly for people who are advocating for so-called dreamers, lots of people in Congress call them dreamer kids, but most of these folks are adults with families. The issue now is this is a piece of the immigration conversation. So the entire conversation, sort of Democrats feel like they've often had the rug pulled out from under them. Often you've had a White House said, okay, we're going to get to a deal on DACA recipients, on potential dreamers. But in exchange, we're going to create an immigration package that, according to recent documents, I think that Vox just they received, perhaps their immigration plan overall is going to penalize green card holders for engaging in public benefits, for sending their kids to Head Start. And so a lot of these sort of compromises seem to be on their face compromise. Okay, we'll give you the DACA issue, but we will create this immigration reform package that over time is going to pretty much zero out immigration from non-European countries. And that's a non-starter. So you have a talks of compromise that actually don't in the end compromise on the issue. And so I think we're going to see over the next month really, really intense conversation there.
This episode of On Point is supported by 23andMe. This Valentine's Day, give someone special a DNA kit from 23andMe. They can receive over 75 detailed online reports about their genetic ancestry, inherited traits, and even information about their health. Go to 23andMe.com/onpoint to get 20% off each kit, now through February 14th. Offer includes free gift wrap.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're getting behind the headlines of this week's news. You can join our conversation. What's your take on the parade of staff departures and forced resignations from the Trump administration? Does the president really have the, quote, best people, like he likes to say? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Some of you are already having your say about what we talked about before, the budget, the early morning deal, and DACA being kicked down the road. D. Kaido says on our website, the defense budgets have increased yet again, and Republicans get to be labeled fiscal conservatives. How can Republicans get away with bumping defense up and still be allowed to complain about the debt and demand cutting social safety programs? Another listener on a website says, I have a feeling that when Paul Ryan says he will solve DACA, he means something very different than what liberals mean when they say it. And in my personal opinion, his solve is much more draconian and heartless. My guests this hour are Eliana Johnson of Politico, Van Newkirk of The Atlantic, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. All right. So, Eliana, this week, President Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, referred to these young immigrants, or some of them are adults by now, but they were brought here illegally when they were young children. They're eligible for the so-called DACA program. He referred to them saying that they failed to apply for legal protections because they were, and pardon my language here, quote, too lazy to get off their asses. Considering the level of fear of deportation that these people live under, why would John Kelly characterize their plight as one of laziness?
Look, one of the things I think we've learned about John Kelly is that for all of his success in imposing some kind of order in the White House, he does lack a political sensibility, and I don't think he has a real trusted communications advisor. He's a military man. He's not a politics man. And I don't think it's pretty clear from several episodes that we've seen when he's gone up to Capitol Hill that he is not a diplomat, to put it lightly. And so I do think that what General Kelly said is a real expression of his true sentiment, which is that for those who are eligible for DACA but have not yet applied, that's a result of laziness. And I think it's important to note that President Trump has said he will extend DACA protection from the 700,000 about young immigrants who have already applied for DACA protection are protected under the program to the approximately 1.8 million young immigrants brought here illegally who have not applied but are nonetheless eligible for protection. And that's what General Kelly was talking about when he said, look, there are these 1.8 million people here who haven't applied, but the president is nonetheless protecting. He was talking about the generosity of the president and how reasonable he's being and said, look, I don't know why they haven't applied. It must be that they're lazy.
All right. Well, Van, the same chief of staff, John Kelly, is engulfed in another scandal over allegations referring to White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter. Reports indicate that the White House had done a background check on Rob Porter and knew for months that two of his former wives accused him of physical abuse, including one of them who got a restraining order, yet the administration took no steps. So tell us, Van, what did the president and the chief of staff know, and when did they know it?
Well, it's been a rough week for Kelly, and I think one of the things he's said in the wake of this this most recent scandal involving Rob Porter, and one of the White House lines has been that they have been they were misled, that when Rob Porter had to file for his clearance, and when he did his interviews with the FBI, and when his ex-wife was interviewed by the FBI, when everybody was interviewed, according to the sources we have, those allegations of abuse were detailed to investigators. And I think right now what we don't quite know is exactly what information was given to the White House, if the OPM had all the information. I think it stands to reason they did have that information, and that there wasn't a determinative action made on that information. And it's actually just baffling, given the credible reports that came out in the media, their initial stance towards protecting Porter, and it just doesn't seem to add up. There was a clearance. He did not have full clearance. He had interim clearance. And the fact that this person who did not have full clearance and who had credible allegations and who had interviews given about those allegations to the FBI, it just seems like almost a no-brainer that he would have been let go at some point by now. And he wasn't.
It is baffling why the fact that the FBI knew these reports and he couldn't get a full security clearance, that it did not raise a red flag. And I want to ask you, Jack Beatty, how could Kelly turn a blind eye to this restraining order and these reports to the FBI of wife battering? A few months ago, the same chief of staff, retired General John Kelly, extolled this bygone era when, in his words, women were sacred and looked upon with great honor. You know, we just talked about his reference to the Dreamers as too lazy to get off their asses. He accused a black congresswoman a few months ago of saying something, and when he was proven wrong by video evidence, he refused to apologize. What does all of this do to Kelly's credibility?
Well, it wounds it considerably, and Axios today reports that the president is really quite angry with Kelly for some of these statements and for just sort of making a hash of this. Kelly reflects something. For one thing, I think from all reports, Mr. Porter was competent. He was that rare thing in the White House, a competent person.
And explain to us, Jack, what exactly he did. Most people don't know what a staff secretary at the White House is. He's not like a shorthand person. What was he actually doing?
No, from what I read, he's the person who controls what the president gets by way of papers, by way of information. He's in charge of that flow. And of course, with President Trump, that's more important than it is perhaps with the ordinary run-of-the-mill president, because often Mr. Trump goes off without knowing what he's talking about. And at least it sounds like Porter tried to keep him up to date on certain on information. So he was competent. But the other thing is, you know, I'm sure Kelly thinks this is wrong to beat up a spouse. On the other hand, it fits in, doesn't it, with this administration? There's a sort of culture of abuse in that White House. Look who the president is. I mean, he was credibly accused by over 15 women of sexual assault. In 1990, his then-wife, Ivana, in a deposition, said that he had attacked her, raped her, and pulled out a hank of her hair in a rage. She later walked that back after being paid $14 million in a settlement and said, oh, no, I didn't mean rape in a literal sense. Mr. Trump, when he was applying for a license to, you know, a gambling license in Atlantic City before the board in New Jersey, he used the fifth. He asked about this deposition. He used the Fifth Amendment nearly 100 times, saying, "Oh, I don't remember. Can't answer that. Will incriminate me." So he's got this on his record, and he's got the campaign. What we heard during the campaign from these women, what we heard on Access Hollywood. And there's a kind of insensitivity in the White House, it seems to me, to these basic human questions.
All right. Well, you know, you've given us a lot there to think about for sure. Eliana, I want to ask you to dig down on this question of the parade of senior staffers. It's not just this Rob Porter. 33% have left or been forced out in the first year of Trump's administration. Is that a record level of churn compared to past White Houses? And what is it going to take for the Trump White House to attract choose, and retain qualified staffers?
I'm not sure that this White House can do all that much about it. But one clear thing that has been preventing this White House from attracting qualified staffers is that they have continued to impose very rigid ideological guidelines, in that they have said that anybody who said anything negative essentially about President Trump on the campaign trail, they've made a few exceptions about it, cannot serve in this White House. That has affected them most profoundly in the realm of national security, because the vast majority of Republican and conservative-leaning national security experts signed letters saying that President Trump was unfit to be president, and they have not been allowed to serve in the Trump administration. So that essentially cast out the Republican national security establishment. That being said, I've had Republicans who have said to me, look, the president needs to start looking not at what people did before 2016, but what they did after 2016. Were they supportive of this president once he began serving in office, or have they simply kept their mouths shut and not criticized him? So that's one thing they could do to attract talent. Beyond that, I'm not sure, aside from changing the way the president speaks and behaves. But we saw a tremendous number of people quit after the first year. That's hurt. And I wrote a piece this week about John Kelly's difficulty in finding a replacement for his deputy, Kirstjen Nielsen, who went to take his own spot at the Department of Homeland Security, which he left in July to serve as White House chief of staff. So there has been a sort of musical chairs going on at the White House. And even I think Kelly himself is a sort of microcosm of this problem, where he's finding difficulty replacing his own people in his office.
Hmm. All right, Jack, I want to ask you, do you know the answer to my earlier question about 33% of senior staffers leaving the Trump administration in the first year? That's 1 in 3. Is this a record level of churn compared to past White Houses?
It appears to be, from my little research. The closest comparison is Ronald Reagan's administration, which was half that, 17%. Now, people say it's typical when an administration is transitioning from the campaign to running the government to lose people who are suitable for the campaign aren't suitable for the White House. And so there's that built into it. But the experts also say that you can expect more churn typically in a second year. So we may see even higher turnover in the year to come. And all of this, of course, throws light on one of the sort of tropes of the Trump campaign. I'm a businessman. I know how to run things. I'm efficient. It you know, any close look at Mr. Trump's sort of upward failure as a businessman, bankruptcy, and mismanagement, would say this guy can't run a two-car funeral. And yet that was one of the arguments that people cited, where he's a businessman, he'll run a tight ship. It's a leaky ship.
Van Newkirk, I want to ask you about one of the most recent departures, and that's former Trump aide Omarosa Manigo Newman. She was fired from The Apprentice three times, I think. She was then fired from the White House. Now she's turning up as a contestant on CBS's Celebrity Big Brother, and she is dishing on the White House. She says she was haunted by Trump's tweets. She also says it is not going to be okay about the Trump presidency. What should we be expecting from her?
Well, on the one hand, this is just an incredibly bizarre turn of events right now. We are seeing the inside of the White House from Celebrity Big Brother, which I guess makes sense given that we have a president who is most notable for his for running a reality show and who had multiple staff who came from reality shows, including Omarosa. Her arc has been very interesting over the past couple months. You had her I was at NABJ when she was on stage there and there was a big controversy about her being on stage. But one of the things that
you mean the National Association of Black Journalists,
yes, Association of Black Journalists. And, you know, that was more of a it got publicity because it was so much of a circus. But on stage, you could sort of see the beginnings of a person who was splitting with President Trump in some ways. She admitted, and you can see very few advisors who admit that the president has been wrong on policy before, and she admitted that there. And only a couple weeks later, you start seeing the controversies with her in the White House. You start seeing that whole saga about her being kicked out or being evicted from the grounds. And I guess it's just a fitting exit for someone who comes in from a reality show. But now you see her back on a reality show and saying the tweets were just too much for me. And it was just too much for me to handle as an aide. And, it's just on the one hand, of course, anybody who exits the White House on bad terms is going to spend their time as sort of an active resistor of that White House. But on the other, I do think there were real she did have some real misgivings that she did express in appearances like the one at that conference that are now becoming, going to be her brand on Celebrity Big Brother.
That's right. Might get her a book deal if she didn't sign some sort of a non-disclosure agreement. But, you know, as what they say about life imitating television. All right. Amidst all this turmoil, the Russia probe grinds on. Congressman Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said this week that the livid rhetoric in opposition to Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election, the opposition that's coming from President Trump and his defenders at Fox News and in Congress, is a signal that the Russia probe is making serious progress.
There is a rising sense of panic clearly within the White House and as well on the Hill. And as a result, we see a tactic we have often seen in criminal cases where when the facts are increasingly incriminating of the defendant, there's an effort to put the government on trial.
Eliana, President Trump's lawyers advised him this week to refuse to sit for any interview with special counsel Robert Mueller. So tell us, where does the Mueller investigation stand now, and is the White House uneasy about it?
I actually think that the advice that the president is getting from his lawyers has been slightly mischaracterized. I think the way that it's been reported in the media is like the president is on the verge of running over to Bob Mueller and sitting down with him for an interview. That's not quite how it is. The president's lawyers are negotiating with Bob Mueller, and they're trying to avoid having to have the president sit for an interview. So what they're doing is they're trying to get themselves in a situation where they can answer as many questions as they can in writing, and then only give the president up for an interview if they absolutely have to. And there's some disagreement among the president's lawyers about what tactics to use with Bob Mueller, but they're not restraining the president, you know, from going over to Bob Mueller's office and sitting down. It's not like he's so eager to go over and do that. So I think that's the best way to characterize the legal situation in the Russia probe right
now.
All
right. And very briefly, Eliana, in the few moments we have left before our break, the White House has signaled it's inclined to release the classified Democratic memo that rebuts the Republican Nunes memo with allegations of abuse by the FBI. What do they gain or lose by releasing this?
I don't think they had all that much of an option, given that there was a bipartisan approval from the House Intelligence Committee to release that memo. And it would look really bad, I think, for the president to not to release it.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. In other news this week, Korean musicians performed John Lennon's Imagine at the opening ceremony of the 2018 Winter Olympics today in South Korea. SpaceX's Falcon Heavy successfully launched on Tuesday from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And Thursday in Philadelphia, the Eagles celebrated their first Super Bowl win with a ticker tape parade. A super fan summed up the emotion.
It's the best thing ever. I've learned a lot. You know, I've learned unity. I've learned we, us, ours. And it's just all the things that comes together as a team. It's just a great thing. It's a great feeling. I love being here.
Well, we love being here, too. And you can join us here. Can you handle more upheaval on Wall Street? Are you for a military parade in Washington? And are you ready for the Olympic Games? Follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Some of you are already having your say. We got this email from Walter referring to our previous conversation about churn at the White House. He says, like the presidents before him, Trump has appointed good men and women. And similarly, some will prove not to be good choices. I can only speak about General Mattis. He's referring to the defense secretary. He's a good man and will continue to perform his duties with honor and integrity as defense secretary. My guests this hour are Eliana Johnson of Politico, Van Newkirk of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. So during a speech in a suburb of Cincinnati this week, the president mocked Democrats for their stone-faced reactions during his State of the Union speech last week.
They were like death. And un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? You know. Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much.
Jack, it is standard operating procedure for members of Congress to sit cross-armed or to grimace at the things they don't like from a president of the opposite party. I lived in Washington for 10 years, and I remember Republicans doing that, with President Obama, and Democrats doing it with President Bush. So what is the president getting at here, and what does it do to the state of civil discourse in our country?
Well, it's another indication of his monarchical ambitions. And there's something else involved here, too. A letter to the editor of the New York Times gets at it shrewdly. This is from a woman named Eva Kitte in New York. She says, I believe that Mr. Trump is purposely using the term in an offhand way to trivialize it, empty it of its gravity. No one throws out the term treason unless he wants to turn it into nothing more than an insult, fearing that it will most likely be applied to him, as she's alluding to the Russia investigation, he wants to make us all gradually forget the weight of the accusation. Well, it's questionable whether Mr. Trump has that amount of forethought and Machiavellian strategy, but no one should doubt his shrewd political instincts. And what he's doing there is kind of making treason seem like a weightless word.
Well, Van, let me get you to jump in here, because Trump tried to pass this off later as a, quote, joke. He's done that many times when things he's said have not gone down so well. He later said, hey, I was just kidding. But I want to know, have lawmakers and the public gone numb to this kind of rhetoric, or is it poisoning the well?
Well, I do think, even if it was a joke, and I think it probably was, it's very difficult to tell with this president whether something's a joke or whether something's real or whether it's retroactively labeled a joke. But that doesn't really matter. I think what's happened here is, regardless of whether he says it in earnest or not, you're going to have people, Republicans mostly, who just say, okay, oh, no, it didn't mean anything. He could say just about anything now, and it seems like Speaker Ryan would just sort of walk it away or talk it away. And it's just the rhetoric has crept so far over the past couple months. Now, it is to the point where he could say just about any sort of damaging thing. And even if he doesn't go back and say it's a joke, you're going to have people who talk it away as a joke for him. So it really doesn't – it doesn't matter, doesn't it seems. And I don't know if that point about him doing this maybe on purpose to take the gravitas out of the word treason is true or is within his realm of what he can and can't do or what he has shown he has done. But – I don't know. It just does seem, even if he's not doing it on purpose, his use of language does end up having the net effect of taking the gravitas out of certain things, of making people less alarmed when perhaps they normally would be.
But things that are very serious. Treason, of course, is incredibly serious. Let's not let listeners forget that. All right. In the run-up to the Olympics this week, North Korea held a military parade on Wednesday. Here's the sound of soldiers greeting, "Dear leader Kim Jong-un," and his wife, Ri Sol-ju, who walked out onto a red carpet to view the parade. The parade marked the day the North Korean People's Army was founded. It's full always in North Korea and other military-dominated regimes of lots of pomp and kind of amazing gymnastics and lots of tanks and stuff. Now President Trump has made his own request for a military parade right down Pennsylvania Avenue. Eliana, what is he trying to prove here?
You know, I think the president... It's pretty clear he went to France last summer. He saw the Bastille Day parade. The president is a showman, and he was impressed. And he said, "I'd like to do the same thing here." I don't think the tacit comparison to North Korea is quite right, though it's some that many people are making. We have had military parades in the past, though I think. The way the president has talked about it and wants to do it, he's making it really a cultural flashpoint in the same way that he sort of made standing for the national anthem in the NFL, where he's saying where it's becoming something like if you're a patriot, you're going to support this, or if you're a Trump supporter, you're going to support this, and if you're not, you're going to be against it. He does really sort of have a genius for identifying these issues that kind of make cultural cleavages. And I do think that that's what this military parade is going to become, even though we've had them in the past, similarly to whether or not we stand for the national anthem.
Eliana, thank you for saying, for making that point, that it's not the same as a North Korean military parade. But with that said, it certainly has caused sort of bipartisan, upset and concern about what's the point of spending all that money on something when we're already the biggest, baddest military in the world. But let's bring in one of our callers and see what they have to say. Sarah is calling from Zion, Illinois. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I do feel that the military parade suggestion is part of Trump's. I feel that he really wants, from the beginning, he's wanted to ingratiate himself or connect himself with the military by putting all the generals, both a few generals, into his administration, and in an attempt to make sure that, or try to have enough support within the military in case he ever wants to suspend, squash democracy and seize power as a dictator, also authoritarian ruler. And I feel that the anti-immigration and racist sentiment, language that he uses and policies, I feel that he's doing that partly as so that people will accept stronger police presence and police power.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah, for your comment. And, there was, as I was saying, pushback on this idea, not just from people like Sarah who made that comment, but also from some former military brass and veterans groups over the cost of staging this parade and what's the point. On Wednesday, Republican Representative John Kennedy of Louisiana voiced his opposition to President Trump's proposed parade, arguing that when you're the most powerful nation in human history, you don't have to show it off.
I don't think it's a particularly good idea. Confidence is silent. insecurities are loud. When you're the most powerful nation in all of human history, you don't have to show it off.
Robert O'Neill, who some of you may remember as the Navy SEAL who fired the shots that killed Osama bin Laden, came out against a parade, too. He said it would make us look like a third world country. Van, is that how it would look to the rest of the world?
I don't know about that. I think you really have to take a long view here to sort of think about what Trump is doing. Pennsylvania Avenue is a Roman avenue. It's built for parades. It looks like a parade route. And there have been military parades before in the United States. And look at what sort of parades do get put on Pennsylvania Avenue, the inaugural parade. That's, in essence, a military parade. It's a huge military presence. If you go, you'll see lots of cool military vehicles. You'll see some armored personnel carriers and Marines in uniform. And so I think the amount to which this has sort of been characterized is out of the character of this country. That's way overblown. But it does appear what Trump is doing here, and I think this is something we were able to note pretty early on, is that he's always campaigning. And campaigning, again, is in the it's a Roman word, and it's linked to being a military person showing off the might. And I don't know that the idea that power is always secure or confident, if that's true. I think power is often insecure, and especially a person like Trump who came to the White House under clouds maybe him not being the rightful president, under clouds of election hacking, under this Russian investigation, he has a ongoing legitimacy crisis. And through history, and not just through American history, but through world history, we've seen people who have dealt with legitimacy crises by basically doing military parades and enhancing the image of their martial power.
Van, I love that you're reminding us of Roman history and what the word campaign even means, where it comes from. And let's not forget, crossing the Rubicon also comes from Roman history. And people throw it out there all the time as an analogy to Trump did this and is he crossing the Rubicon. So thank you for bringing us back to history. So meanwhile, Vice President Pence has been in Asia this week. During a speech in Japan on Wednesday, Pence said that the U.S. will continue to intensify pressure on North Korea.
The United States of America will soon unveil the toughest and most aggressive round of economic sanctions on North Korea ever. And we will continue to isolate North Korea until it abandons its nuclear and ballistic missile program once and for all.
Eliana, does the threat hold any water? They haven't enforced Russia sanctions.
I do think that the threat holds water because I think we've seen the U.S. and China at the U.S.'s urging crack down steadily on North Korea. What we don't know, I think, is if the crackdown will be sufficient to get the North North Koreans to abandon their nuclear program. I think that's unlikely, but we certainly have seen the ratcheting up of pressure on the part of both the U.S. and the Chinese, and I think that the crisis will come to a head.
Jack, with the opening of the Olympic Games today, and of course, Vice President Pence is there, we are seeing, though, in the background, and also in the foreground, for that matter, in the opening ceremonies for anyone who's streamed it live, we're seeing a thaw or something approaching it between North and South Korea. Their teams are marching under a single flag. Where does this leave the United States, which has always been in this triad with South Korea and Japan against North Korea? Suddenly, there's this warming between North and South.
Yes, you know, the South Korean government really wants to improve relations with the North. The American government wants to deal with the nuclear issue, wants denuclearization. These goals are in some ways compatible, and in other ways, and more fundamentally, are opposed. The South Korean president, Mr. Moon, made a speech this week about this, and he said, "I ask the people to show their support in maintaining and expanding the dialogue with the North, as they will protect a candle in the wind." Well, the Americans are, if not blowing against that candle, they're ready to. I mean, the vice president in Japan came close to talking about regime change in North Korea. And there's a fear in South Korea, according to the reporting, that if the Moon rapprochement with the North does not show more results after the Olympics in terms of, you know, inter-Korean relations, then the Americans can say, look, you tried diplomacy, it didn't work, now is the time to bloody the nose of Kim, to strike at his weapons.
And these are the sanctions, of course, that Eliana was talking about, and Vice President Pence, who's there in South Korea now, his guest at the Olympic Games, is the father of Otto Warmbier, the college student who was imprisoned in Pyongyang for taking a propaganda poster off a wall at a hotel. He was not allowed to come home until he was already in a coma, and he died shortly after being returned to the United States. So obviously, Vice President Pence is also trying to highlight North Korea's human rights abuses. All right, quickly, Eliana, in the short time we have left, it's been a bumpy ride on the stock market this week. Stocks had been going up for almost 9 years. Now we've seen a steep drop several times this week. It's unnerving, but how bad is it? Trump has been conspicuously silent.
Exactly. I really think that the turbulence in the stock market shows the peril for the president of taking credit for the success of the stock market and for the economy more broadly. And I hope that we'll see him do that less. It's true that people feel more positively about the economy, but in general, the economic performance is about the same as it's been over the past couple of years. The economy doing well, but not quite clear whether it's because of President Trump, and the stock market can quite easily take a turn for the worse, as we saw this week.
Well, we did a full show on this Wednesday, so listeners can catch our podcast on what happened to the Dow and what it means. Eliana Johnson of Politico, thank you so much for being with us. Van Newkirk of The Atlantic, great to have you with us today. And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you. Have a great weekend. You can continue the conversation and get our podcast, onpointradio.org. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point. Point.